I understood what Christophorovich was after. He wanted me to admit, like Fikrit back in my cell, that I was a member of a Trotskyist anti-Bolshevik center. He wanted to parade the poet Mandelstam at a public trial. Obviously, my confession would have more impact than that of an illiterate silver medalist at the 1932 Vienna Games. But it is one thing to name the names of those who actually heard my sad little epigram, and quite another to invent a conspiracy that could then be used at the show trials rumored to be in the works of Zinoviev and Kamenev, of Bukharin, despite the esteem in which most Bolsheviks held him, of Trotsky himself if Stalin could lure him back, like Gorky, from exile. And so I stuck to my story, which was, after all, the truth. Not that this counted for much in Purgatorio. Christophorovich was nothing if not tenacious. He brought to mind the doggedness of a lover who refuses to take no for an answer, who is disappointed by a yes, because it cuts short the pleasure to be had from breaking your will. He had the endurance of a marathon runner. He kept at me for hours on end, promising me the state would be lenient with me and mine if I testified against the designated instigators, threatening me with execution if I failed to give him what he wanted, what, I'm supposing here, he needed in order for his career to flourish. I'm aware that Nadenka takes the view that recounting this episode is therapeutic, in the sense that it sheds light on everything that happened afterward. Personally, I am not persuaded it serves any useful purpose. What's to be gained by reliving the execution? To this day, I am amazed they didn't shoot me straight off the night they brought me to the Lubyanka. I half expected to be put to death every time they took me from my cell. I had heard rumors of prisoners being executed in the vaulted cellars that once served as storage rooms for the insurance company, and only managed to breathe again when the freight elevator started up instead of down. Until the night. The nightmarish night. The heart-aching night when it started down. Now, I'll do my execution. The next evening, at the hour they usually came to get me for interrogation, three brutes I had never set eyes on turned up at the door of my cell. Two of them carried an ordinary wooden chair to the cell and strapped Sergo onto it with canvas belts. The third brought the heel of his boot down on my chinaware bowl, shattering it into pieces. "You won't be needing this anymore," is how he explained the gesture. He reached for my upper arm and, hauling me roughly to my feet, twisted both my arms behind my back and bound them tightly together at the wrists. Fikrit, bless his soul, climbed to his feet as if he intended to intervene. The guard lazily rested a hand on the butt of the pistol in his web holster and stared down the giant until he slowly backed up against the wall. I think I managed to say, "Thank you, Fikrit," though it is entirely possible my lips moved but no words emerged. With the toe of my shoe, I edged my volume of Pushkin across the floor toward my cellmate.
"I cannot read," Fikrit said.
"Learn," I said. "Start with Pushkin. If you can one day make out his words, you won't need to read anything else in your lifetime." The two guards carried Sergo from the cell on the chair. Prodded along by the third guard, I followed. At the door I turned back to see, through my tears, the giant weightlifter bowing farewell to me from the waist, his knuckles scraping the floor in the style of peasants from the mountains of Azerbaijan. Our little group made its way down the corridor, through several steel doors to the open freight elevator. When the five of us were inside, the guard pulled the throttle back. "No, no. Keep recording. I just need to catch my breath." And the elevator and my stomach and my heart and my head began descending deeper into hell. Christophorovich was waiting in the vaulted cellar when the elevator reached the basement. He was wearing the leather apron over his uniform and holding a large, bored naval revolver. The guard carried Sergo from the elevator and set him down in the middle of a patch of earth covered with sawdust. They forced me to kneel beside the chair. I could see Comrade Interrogator chewing on his lower lip as he removed the five enormous bullets from the revolver, then thumbed one of them back in and spun the cylinder as if he intended to play Russian roulette. The three guards backed off. Christophorovich said, "Who wants to go first? Age before beauty? Talent before mediocrity? Urban intellectual before rural hick? What will it be?" I heard Sergo spitting words from between his pus-swollen lips. "Fuck.
darling, is what I think he said. Christophorovich called over to the guards. It would seem we have someone who is impatient to meet his maker, comrades. Never let it be said I don't attend to the last wishes of the condemned. Stepping behind a chair, he held the revolver at arm's length and thrust the bore into the nape of Sergo's neck, and he pulled the trigger. The hammer struck an empty chamber. Sergo produced an anguished groan, almost as if he regretted still being alive. "Your turn, Mandelstam," Christophorovich announced. "You have been condemned and sentenced to the highest measure of punishment." "But there was no trial," I cried out. "The trial was held without you." He pressed the revolver into the back of my neck and pulled the trigger on another empty chamber. My knees gave way and my forehead pitched forward onto the sawdust. Christophorovich took a grip on my collar and hauled me upright, then turned back to Sergo and, aiming at his neck, again pulled the trigger. A deafening roar reverberated through the vaulted cellars as the chair and the body strapped to it spilled sideways. The sound came back from so many directions I thought other prisoners were being shot in other parts of the basement. Clots of blood, of brain, spattered on my shirt. "Are you a believer, Mandelstam?" the interrogator demanded as he thumbed another bullet into the revolver and gave a spin to the cylinder. I must have said yes because he asked, "In what?" "In poetry." "Poetry won't save you now," he said, and he pressed the revolver into the nape of my neck. I could feel warm urine soaking through my trousers as he... Oh, Jesus. As he pulled the thing, the trigger. I heard what must have been the dry thud of the hammer hitting the firing pin, and vomited on the sawdust under my knees. It took an eternity for me to realize that if I could vomit, I must be alive. Christophorovich and the guard started laughing, piano at first, then louder until they were roaring with laughter, and the laughter, like the shot that had put an end to Sergo's suffering, echoed through the vaulted cellars. "You were luckier than Sergo," Christophorovich managed to say. "Take him back to his cell. We'll try again another night." What was going through my head at the moment of execution? The cliché has it that your life flashes before your eyes. Not with me. It didn't. I made an effort to summon an image of my wife, but I couldn't remember what she looked like. Try as I might, I was unable to call up an erotic image. I struggled to remember a line, any line, from one of my poems. And failing that, words, nothing came to mind. I strained to come up with a single line from the Divine Comedy, but drew a blank. I couldn't even recall who had wiped the stains of hell off Dante. My brain was devoid of thought. Thought had been shoved aside by fear, as if the cells in the lobes of my brain had scattered in their panic to get out of the path of the foreign object about to come crashing into their hive. I am incapable of telling you what happened after my mock execution. Only now do I see that he didn't intend to kill me, only break me. There are gaps in the story that no amount of concentration can fill. It will have been some time after my return to the cell, whether an hour or a day I cannot say, that I tried to cut my wrist with a shard of chinaware. Fikrit stopped me as I was sawing at the vein. He tore a strip of cloth from the tail of my shirt and bandaged the wound, which, although not deep, was very painful. Curiously, the pain became a source of euphoria. I can remember my mother once telling me, when I was stung by nettles while climbing out of a lake near Warsaw, that nothing makes you more aware you are alive than pain. Cowering in a corner of a cell in the Lubyanka, with Sergo's brain staining my shirt, was not what my mother had in mind when she spoke of the advantages of pain. Still, the terrible truth is that I was elated to be alive. I must have been in this euphoric state for days on end, because if I was again taken for interrogation or execution, I have no recollection of it. It is strange what does surface in a brain under stress. I remember looking a long, long time at my shoes, mystified by the absence of laces. I remember studying the shards of chinaware on the cell floor, trying to figure out what the object had been before it was broken. I remember wondering, when Fikrit shyly handed a small book to me, what an illiterate weightlifter was doing with a copy of Pushkin. When I came to my senses, or what was left of them, I found myself astride the stool with the sawed-off front legs in Christophorovich's office. I had no idea of how much time had gone by since my execution. Comrade interrogator had been questioning me, but, complaining of stomach cramps, he had gone off to the toilet and left me alone with Stalin, so extraordinarily lifelike in the photograph on the wall behind the table I half expected to hear his voice. I sat there for I don't know how long, lost in the enormous room with the pleated curtains on the windows and the alarm clock and the remains of a supper on the table, staring at Stalin. I have long subscribed to the notion that, for better or worse, a man's character is written on his face. Like most Russian intellectuals, I have been mesmerized by Stalin, wondering what he was like behind the mask. I imagined having conversations with him in the course of which his confidences would shed light on what had transformed him into a practicing paranoid. My diagnosis, based on no medical evidence, only instinct, who assumed everyone was guilty of something. Pasternak and I used to circle endlessly around the subject. I have been known to invent biographical details of Soso Djugashvili's life that left Boris in stitches. Had Stalin been marked by a violent childhood in Gori, or his bank-robbing exploits to raise money for the Bolsheviks, or his several exiles in the frozen tundra under the Arctic Circle, or some particularly brutal experience during the Civil War, or the death, rumored to be suicide, of his young wife 18 months earlier? Peering intently into the face of Stalin, I found no ready answers. You couldn't read much into formal portraits or photographs of Stalin, because they were always retouched to erase the smallpox scars, to add ruddiness to his cheeks and kind-heartedness to the shadow of a smirk playing on his lips. I looked around to be sure the room was empty, then made my way past the table to take a closer look at Stalin's face. I confess, without shame, that I found myself being drawn to him with the kind of mesmeric attraction I up to then had experienced only with members of the weaker sex. His reproving eyes gnawed at me from the wall, and then, weird as this must sound to you, I found myself being sucked into the photograph, sucked through it. My ears were ringing with unformed words. Lines from a poem I had not yet written began to knock like a fist on a window. I came to him, to his core, entering the Kremlin without a pass, in pain and with a guilty head, tearing the sackcloth canvas space. I hardly dared open my eyes. When I did, I found myself adrift in a murkiness that muted all sound, and only gradually dissipated, like thick morning fog, at which point I discovered I was halfway along a narrow corridor. Portraits of the generals who defeated Napoleon were hanging on both sides, each illuminated by a small lamp attached to the top of the gilt frame. I touched one wall with the tips of my fingers. It felt cold and damp. I could sense the soft pile of the thick carpet under my feet. I grasped there were two possibilities. Either I was not imagining this, or I was imagining that I was not imagining it. At the far end of the corridor, two men in tight-fitting European suits were sitting on either side of a low table playing chess with minuscule pieces made out of clay. The older of the two, with fine grey hair falling to his collarbones, struck me as vaguely familiar. "Mandelstam?" he called out, waving me forward. I must have looked mystified, because the other man, younger than the first and prematurely bald, repeated the question. "You are Mandelstam?" I nodded. "I don't have a Kremlin pass," I said, hoping to avoid trouble by admitting my blunder straight away. "What makes you think you're in the Kremlin?" the younger man demanded. "The portraits of the generals behind me," I said, "are known to hang in the Kremlin." Amused by my amateur detective work, he pulled an appointment book from a file cabinet and ran his finger down a list of names. He put a tick next to one of them. "You don't require a pass," he said. "Stalin is expecting you. Through the double doors there. Don't bow or scrape or anything like that. He detests protocol. He's not a Tsar, after all, merely Secretary General of the party." A big man I recognized from newspaper photographs as Stalin's bodyguard Vlasic pulled open the double doors and, never lifting his eyes from me, stepped aside. "Just walk up to him as you would to any ordinary individual and say your name," he instructed me. "If he offers his hand, shake it." I heard the doors close behind me when I had gone through. Joseph Stalin was sitting at the far end of the long rectangular room, behind an enormous desk piled high with books. One entire wall was lined with ornate Russian stoves. The thick drapes on the window behind him were partially open, and I could make out the onion-shaped domes of St. Basil's Cathedral, illuminated by anti-aircraft searchlights, which meant that I was indeed, as I supposed, inside the Kremlin. What light there was in the room came from a low desk lamp and an arched reading lamp hanging over an upholstered chair. The man known in Kremlin circles as the Kozyaïn wearing a military tunic open at the neck and smoking a cigarette, got to his feet and came around the desk.
"Stalin," he muttered.
"Mandelstam," I replied.
"I know who you are," he said. "Your reputation precedes you."
I heard myself say, "Yours trails after you like a wake," and immediately regretted my impudence. Did I actually say these words, or is this how I would have liked to conduct myself? My comment, assuming I made it, irritated the head of the household.
"Therein lies the problem," he said. "Wakes fade away after a time."
He glanced down at my shoes. "What happened to your laces?"
"I ask myself the same thing," I said.
He raised his eyebrows, obviously perplexed, and after an instant's hesitation, awkwardly held out his hand. I just as awkwardly took it. He produced a packet of Kazbek Papirosi from a pocket of his tunic and offered me one of the cigarettes with their long cardboard tips. A gunmetal cigarette lighter materialized in his stumpy fingers. I took hold of his wrist and leaned toward him to bring the end of my cigarette to the flame. Stalin couldn't have missed noticing that my hand was trembling, but was discreet enough not to comment on it. The drag on a cigarette, the first since my arrest, went a long way toward calming my frayed nerves.
"Let's talk," he suggested, gesturing toward the upholstered chair, pulling over the high-backed wicker chair so that we were facing each other, our knees nearly touching.
"About what should we talk?" I asked.
"You can start by explaining how it is that every composer and painter and writer and poet in Russia, except you, is ready to dedicate a work to Stalin."
"With all respect, if you have the dedication of every composer and painter and writer and poet, I don't see why you need mine."
In person, Stalin looked nothing like his photographs. He was a good deal shorter than the figure in his portraits, almost dwarf-like even. His left arm, visibly withered, hung stiffly from a hunched shoulder. He had the beginnings of a paunch. His face, filled with smallpox scars and freckles, was ruddy enough, but on closer inspection I got the impression he applied what women refer to as rouge. His teeth were in worse condition than mine. His eyes were yellow. The mustache on his upper lip was thickened and darkened with shoe wax. His scalp was dry and peeling in places. Black hairs protruded from his nostrils. Like the poet Mandelstam in his most recent incarnation, Stalin didn't beat about the bush. "Let's be clear, Mandelstam. I am not afraid of dying. I looked death in the face dozens of times as a young revolutionist, as the commissar charged with defending Tsaritsyn during the Civil War. Now what I fear, what I loathe, is the fading of my wake after the passage of my ship. I send off valises filled with rubles to that Ukrainian rejuvenation quack, Bogomolets, to finance his experiments. He is said to believe that drinking water from glaciers accounts for Georgians living into ripe old age, but I don't put much stock in the professor's magic potions. With or without water from glaciers, the curtain will one day come down on my life. And then what? All those objects named after Stalin, the tanks, the tractors, the warships, the factories, all of them will sooner or later disappear, to be replaced by new tanks and new tractors and new warships and new factories, named after a new Secretary General. The limousine I ride in is a ZIS. The initials, as you no doubt know, stand for Zavod Imeni Stalina, the factory named after Stalin. When the last ZIS finishes up in a museum for antique automobiles, people will have forgotten what the initials stood for. The streets in the cities named after Stalin, even the cities like Stalingrad, will eventually revert to their original names. So where, I put the question to the poet Mandelstam, where can I expect to find a flicker of life after death? The answer is, if there is such a thing as immortality, it resides in the poetry of a genius. Stalin jabbed the nicotine-stained finger into my knee. You are a stubborn prick, Mandelstam. Your pal Pasternak came up with a poem, albeit quite run-of-the-mill. So go forward without flinching as long as you're alive. Shostakovich delivered a whole symphony he described as a creative reply to Stalin's accurate criticism, though it gives me a splitting headache when I am forced to sit through a performance. Now that I think of it, maybe that's what the asshole intended. I should have Shostakovich arrested for wrecking my sleep. Thousands of lesser poets and writers celebrate Stalin in 100 different languages. Nobody in Russia publishes a book, a pamphlet,
a thesis on philosophy or philology or astronomy or linguistics without acknowledging his debt to Stalin. Do you know Kachaturian's Stalin song? He started to hum the first bars in the sweet-pitched voice of the choir boy he once was. Well, you get the idea. The Khozayin pulled another cigarette from his pack and lit it on the embers of the one in his mouth, then filled his lungs with smoke. Don't make the mistake of thinking this conversation is easy for me, Mandelstam. I'm not used to asking for something. It is more usual that the very few things I require are offered. It would seem that Stalin can have anything his heart desires in all of Russia, with the exception of your poem. I ask you, man to man, face to face, is such a situation normal? I was, I can see now as I look back on my encounter with Stalin, so flabbergasted by the turn the conversation had taken that I couldn't find words to reply. Taking my silence for stubbornness, Stalin became exasperated. It is unusual to come across someone who does not fear the Secretary General who runs the party and, through it, the state. In other circumstances, I could admire such a man. Let's be sure you know what's at stake here, Mandelstam. Scraping back his chair, he stood up and came around behind me and began talking to the nape of my neck. Do you have an idea of how much the state weighs? The weight of the state? Yes, with all its factories and dams and trains and aircraft and trucks and ships and tanks. Nobody can calculate the weight of the state. It is in the realm of astronomical figures. And do you think one man can resist the pressure of this astronomical weight? I will have your poem, Mandelstam. If for some reason I can't have your poem, you will be crushed under the weight of the state. His bluntness left me short of breath. I am not a threat to Soviet power, was all I could think to say. He circled around the upholstered chair and stood over me, sucking on his cigarette, studying me with his angry yellow eyes. You are most certainly a threat to Soviet power. Someone who refuses to bend to Stalin's will may bend to the will of his enemies. There is no middle ground between worshipping the ground Stalin walks on and desecrating it. Stalin hauled his wicker chair back behind his desk and sank into it, lost for a long moment in reflection. So what's your answer, Mandelstam? He said. I haven't got all night. Will you do your part to secure the Secretary General's immortality? I would if I could. His eyes narrowed in suspicion. What does that mean? Even if I were to compose such an ode, it would be useless to you. I would be going through the motions. I don't really know you well enough to compose something so true it cuts to the bone, which is what a poem must do if it is to have life after the poet's death. For me, you are a larger-than-life icon, a legend, a myth, not a flesh-and-blood human being. There is no way I can counterfeit it. Stalin is made of flesh and blood like you. He straightened in his chair. What is your age? 43. You look older. I happen to be 13 years your senior. But the difference in age notwithstanding, we have a lot in common. Both our fathers were in the leather business. Yours sold leather in Warsaw. Mine was a shoemaker in Georgia. It is not to be excluded that my father made shoes using leather supplied by your father. Stranger things have been known to happen. In addition, we share a common interest in poesy. I myself have written romantic verse. Several of my poems were published in a Georgian newspaper under the pen name Soselo, before I became a full-time revolutionist. That's not all. It is certainly no accident we both married women whose name, Nadezhda, signifies hope in Russian. We may hope for different things, but we share an inclination toward hope. And curiously, you and I have the same forename. During one of my stretches in exile, the locals in Solvychegodsk, in the Arkhangelsk Oblast, took to calling me Osip, which is a popular Russian form of Joseph up north. I even signed Oddball Osip on love letters I wrote to a schoolgirl there named Pelageya. Being a revolutionist, robbing banks to finance the sacred proletarian enterprise was not without advantages. You could get into any girl's pants. Being a poet was not without advantages, too, I said. But I could see he was lost in his own life and hadn't heard me. By God, those were the days. Exhilarating, dangerous, sheer fun. In Gori, in Tiflis, I was a local hero. People in the Caucasus respected me for who I was. Not, he waved the back of his hand at the Kremlin compound, where I lived. Stalin remembered I was there. Did you say something? No. He nodded absently. Jesus, I haven't thought about Pelageia in years. I even know her name. Pelageia Onofrieva. I must make a note to have my people find out what became of her. I thought I might stand a better chance of ingratiating myself with Stalin if I could keep him talking about himself. Siberian exile must have been a bitter experience, I said. Stalin blew air through his lips. Bitter doesn't begin to describe it. I was banished 7 times. 7 times I survived to make my way back to European Russia. I'll tell you what kept me going in exile, aside from shacking up with girl prisoners so the both of us could keep warm at night. There were the books. Reading is what kept me going. Every time a prisoner died, we'd fight to see who'd get his books. I usually won. My 7th exile ended when I raced across the country to Petrograd, after the Tsar was overthrown, to direct the Bolsheviks until Lenin negotiated a safe passage through Germany and returned from abroad. Siberian winter is best described as hell frozen over. Try to visualize your piss freezing before it hits the ground. Try to visualize sucking on icicles of frozen vodka to get drunk. Summers, which were as short as a blink of the eye, weren't much better with their swarms of mosquitoes. As soon as the permafrost started to thaw, I joined the other prisoners crawling under the women's shower house. When we spotted water dripping through joints in the floorboards, we would squirm along the ground until we were directly underneath, and tried to look up through the dripping water to see the naked woman showering above. And if you could keep your eyes open long enough, you could make out the tear.
The tear?
The slash in the crotch, the slit. The cunt, you idiot! You ought to be familiar with cunts, Mandelstam. I have been told you get laid a lot. The checker file on your wife says she is an occasional lesbian, that you and your wife are both having an affair with a theater actress, that you sometimes watch them, and she sometimes watches the two of you, and you sometimes do it à toi, in the French manner. I myself have never fucked more than one woman at a time, but it's not for lack of trying. I made several attempts to talk my Nadezhda into experimenting with free sex in the Bolshevik spirit, but for all her revolutionist credentials, did you know she used to type speeches for Lenin before the revolution? She was too puritanical to liberate herself from the bourgeois definition of marriage. These days I fuck my housekeeper, Valechka. The only thing she knows is the missionary position, which has a certain irony, since what I preach is the gospel according to Marx. I watched as Stalin poured water into a glass from a pitcher, then measured out drops from a vial. Tincture of iodine, he said. I don't trust doctors. I treat my several ailments with 10 drops twice a day. Works wonders. And pulling a face in anticipation of the awful taste, he swallowed the contents of the glass. With luck, all these anecdotes will break down the wall between us. Maybe you'll begin to see me as flesh and blood, after all, which will inspire you to write a serious poem to Stalin, as opposed to a treacherous little polemic. I could only nod in agreement. Who could rule out the possibility that, knowing these intimate details of his life, I might be able to fabricate an ode to Stalin and avoid being crushed by the state? He reached over to angle the desk lamp so that it illuminated a framed photograph on the wall between us. That's me at Lenin's funeral procession. As you can see, as all of Russia knows, I was one of the pallbearers carrying his coffin on our shoulders toward Red Square. There was so much ice, I was terrified I'd lose my footing and the coffin would fall to the ground and open, and Lenin's corpse would spill onto the street. I was devoted to Lenin, it goes without saying, though the old man, as we called him, could be a prick sometimes. To begin with, he wasn't very courageous. While the rest of us were out in the Petrograd streets making a revolution, he hid in that girls' school we used as an HQ. When he did work up the nerve to leave Smolny, he wrapped his face in bandages so nobody would recognize him. I'll let you in on a state secret, Mandelstam. To speak plainly, Lenin wasn't very Leninist. Oh, he could theorize about proletarian revolution until the cock crowed. But when it came to the day-to-day implementation of the theory, he dithered. 2 steps forward, 1 step back, was his idea of progress. Lenin didn't have the guts to attack the peasant problem head-on. It took a Stalin to do that. History will vindicate me. Collectivization, despite the occasional inconvenience to a handful of peasants, will be the crowning glory of my legacy. Stalin had collapsed into the wicker back of his chair by now, smoking his cigarette in short, agitated puffs, clearly caught up in recounting his life story. Listen, I was the only one in the immediate group around Lenin who had peasant roots, the only one who had been an active revolutionist leading Bolshevik squads in street fighting, as opposed to a shitty coffeehouse intellectual. Which made me the odd man out, the sore thumb in the superstructure. When it came to the pecking order, no one took me seriously. Well, they all underestimated me, didn't they? That was the real secret of my rise to the top of the heap. They were lulled by my Georgian accent. They laughed behind my back at the grammatical errors I made when I spoke Russian. They took me for a country chore bacon who couldn't survive in the big city. In the end, it was child's play to fuck over those Jews. Trotsky and Kamenev and Zinoviev. Even Karl Heinrich Marx, the vandal who had the misfortune to come from a long line of rabbis. He's probably turning over in his London grave at the thought that someone who doesn't really understand all his bullshit is the leader of the world communist movement. I even outsmarted that asshole Bukharin, who understood Marx's bullshit, or pretended to. How did I do it? To begin with, I took the job none of them wanted. General Secretary of the party. I did what none of them wanted to dirty his hands doing, the boring routine day-to-day chores. And so they went on theorizing and scheming and preening, while I built up an apparat loyal to me and ran the country. And what did I get by way of a thank you? After Lenin's first stroke, he was surrounded by vultures who did everything they could to turn him against me. I'll let you in on another secret. Days before the old man kicked the bucket, they prevailed on him to write a testament denouncing Stalin for, get this, his crude behavior toward Krupskaya, Lenin's hagfish of a wife, who was furious with me for talking about his affairs with girls in a typing pool in front of her. Needless to say, I suppressed the so-called last testament. I keep the original, written out in Lenin's wobbly hand in my desk. You don't believe me? Here. He snatched a sheet of paper from the drawer, and waving his good hand the way I do when I recite, began to read aloud from it. Stalin is too coarse. I suggest to the comrades that they think of a way of transferring Stalin from the position of General Secretary, assigning someone more tolerant, more polite, less capricious, and so on and so forth. Well, you get the gist. Me, capricious. That's a good one. After Lenin cashed in his chips, Krupskaya threatened to circulate a copy until I warned her, to her face. I'd appoint a new widow for Lenin if she opened her trap about the testament. You can bet the bitch shut up. Stalin brought up a laugh from the pit of his stomach. Just because she shit in the same toilet as Lenin didn't give her the right to walk over me. One of the several telephones on the desk rang. Stalin plucked the receiver off the hook and held it to his ear. Agreed, he said. Of course they were plotting to kill Stalin. That's what I would be doing in their shoes. As for the trial, it will lend credibility to the proceedings if foreign journalists and foreign diplomats are permitted to witness the confessions. On the matter of the opera Onegin, which I attended last night, I found it outrageous that Tatiana appears on stage in a sheer gown. Stalin is not giving instructions, but merely expressing an opinion. Whatever happened to Bolshevik modesty? Send a memorandum to the director saying Stalin was overheard remarking that Ivan the Terrible, a great and wise Tsar, beat his pregnant daughter-in-law for wearing immodest clothing. Let our cultural workers draw the appropriate conclusions. Hanging up the phone, he glanced over at me. I lost the thread of our conversation. You were talking about the people who tried to turn Lenin against you, I reminded him. Yes, yes. It's the price one pays for success, Stalin plunged on, lighting yet another cigarette on the embers of the one that had burned close to his lips. They tried to turn Lenin against me and almost succeeded. 10 years later, the same pricks were at it again, trying to turn my own wife against me. I could see that the mere mention of his wife had aroused strong emotions. His brow creased in pain, his eyes narrowed in irritation. Our marriage was never a bed of roses, as they say. To begin with, I was 22 years older and more of a father figure than a lover in her eyes. She actually left me once, running off to Petrograd with the children. But I went after her and sweet-talked her into coming home. And then in the early 30s, with collectivization underway and nobody quite sure how things would turn out, Bukharin filled her head with cock-and-bull stories of starving children with swollen stomachs begging at train stations, of a Soviet-organized famine spreading across the Ukraine, of mass deportations, of summary executions. Looking back, I can see that Bukharin poisoned our marriage. Nadezhda and I argued bitterly. I fended off her accusations, quoting Lenin's line, not that he acted on it himself, about the need for the peasants to do a bit of starving. The trick, he said, was not to lose your nerve. The peasants who resisted collectivization, who destroyed their cattle and horses and grain, calculated we would lose our nerve and feed them. Zinoviev and Kamenev and Bukharin and Nadezhda were losing theirs, but I wasn't losing mine. I was the same Stalin who risked his skin robbing banks in the Caucasus, who forced the defeatist Bolshevik commanders at Tsaritsyn onto a barge and sank it in the Volga, drowning all the traitors and saving the city from the whites. Things between Nadezhda and me came to a head at the Kremlin banquet, celebrating the 15th anniversary of the revolution. Stalin shook his head in dismay. That was 18 months ago, but the scene is so fresh in my mind's eye it might have happened yesterday. What happened? I knew Nadezhda was in one of her dark moods the moment I put a polka on the American gramophone. Anastas Mikoyan, my Armenian Politburo pal, sashayed across the room and held out his arms to Nadezhda to dance, but she insolently turned her back on him. Anastas, who, with his little Hitler moustache, fancied himself something of a dandy, shrugged off the insult and wound up dancing with Voroshilov's wife, Ekaterina. Nadezhda snubbed my old Georgian friend Beria, the Czechist responsible for cleansing Transcaucasia of wreckers, when he tried to chat her up. She once pretended that he was known to have a weakness for raping young female athletes, but I had no reason to believe this was anything more than grist for the Kremlin gossip mill. I worked the room, making small talk with Bukharchik, as I called Bukharin. I liked to give everyone in my entourage a nickname, teasing him about the age difference between him and the piece of ass, Anna Larina, whom he'd been openly courting. I remember telling him, "You outspit me this time," an allusion to his fucking someone even younger than my Nadezhda was when I took up with her. As stunning as Anna Larina was, she didn't hold a candle to my wife, who looked particularly beautiful the night of the banquet. She was wearing the black dress, embroidered with rose petals that her brother Pavel had brought back from Berlin. She'd done up her hair for once, pinning a tea rose in it. When we'd worn ourselves out dancing and singing Georgian songs, we drifted over to the long table piled with soup tureens and platters of salted fish and lamb, along with bottles of vodka with frost on them. I sat down in the middle of the table next to the film actress, Galina Yegorova, the wife of a Red Army commander who had been conveniently dispatched to run a military district in Central Asia. The night of the banquet, Galina was wearing one of those low-cut dresses you see in French magazines. Have you ever caught her on the screen? She's not much of an actress, but I am in a position to testify that she's damn good in bed. Nadezhda sat across from me, favoring me with jealous looks every time I let my eyes wander to Galina's tits. For some reason, Molotov and Yagoda began boasting about the dizzy success of our collectivization program. Lazar Kaganovich, my railway commissar, had just come back from the North Caucasus, where he'd organized cattle cars to ship peasants who refused to join collectives off to Siberia. Koshorovich, as I'd nicknamed Lazar, so nobody would forget his Israelite roots, pulled a slip of paper from his pocket and began reeling off numbers. Ukraine, 145,000. North Caucasus, 71,000. Lower Volga, 50,000. Belarusia, 42,000. West Siberia, 50,000. East Siberia, 30,000. I tried to shut him up, but he was too drunk to spot the dark looks I dispatched in his direction. Nadezhda called across the table. "What are those numbers, Lazar?" His eyes were glazed over from alcohol, and he didn't see the storm coming. "Why, deportations, what else?" he replied. I attempted to distract Nadezhda with a toast. "To the destruction of the enemies of socialism," I called out, raising my glass. Everyone around the table raised their glasses and repeated the toast. Everyone except my own, Dadochka. She sat there in simmering silence, staring at me across the table with what can only be described as hate in her eyes. If, as the peasants say, looks could kill, I would have been struck dead on the spot. "Why don't you drink?" I demanded. "Are you for or against the enemies of socialism?" When she looked away without answering, My Georgian temper got the best of me, and I threw a handful of orange peel at her. "Hey, you, drink!" I shouted. And Nadezhda, humiliating me in front of everyone, shouted back, "Don't hey you me!" And then she turned insult into injury by storming out of the banquet hall. What could I do? She had offended me in front of the entire Politburo. You could have heard a pin drop as I settled back into my chair. I tried to pass the incident off as a domestic squabble. "I am married to a fool," I said, flinging cigarette ends at the empty chair across from me. "All women are torn." I gestured toward the genitals of the actress next to me, and for some reason unknown even to Marx, we have become prisoners of this tear. We serve life sentences. Yagoda had the good sense to laugh, and the others followed his lead, and soon everyone was roaring with laughter. Everyone except me. "I'm not boring you, am I, Mandelstam? Do you want to hear the rest, or would you prefer to return to your cell?"
"I am certainly not bored."
When the party broke up, I threw an army greatcoat over my shoulders and took Galina off in one of the Packards to my dacha outside of Moscow at Zubolovo. We spent a few unpleasant hours together. She was worried that Nadezhda, in a fit of jealousy, would have her arrested. I had to reassure her that I was the only one who could authorize the arrest of someone in the superstructure. Still, the damage was done. It's hard to fuck a woman who is not wet with desire. So we wound up playing billiards. In the early hours of the morning, Vlasic drove me home through the deserted streets of Moscow while I dozed in the back seat. I came awake as we passed through the Troitsky gates into the Kremlin compound. I remember a light snow was falling. It had already erased the footprints of the guests who had quit the banquet hours before. Someone had left a hall light on for me, but no one was stirring in our apartment in the Poteshny Palace. My anger had accumulated, it's true. The daily drumbeat of bad news from the Ukraine made everyone edgy. Yagoda had passed along word that Zinoviev and Kamenev, and even Bukharin, were spreading it about that Stalin had fucked up. They were accusing me of having launched the drive for collectivization, thinking the peasants would greet us with open arms, of not having a plan to deal with the chaos in the event they didn't. Nadezhda's public rudeness that night had been the last straw. I stormed into her bedroom and found her still wearing the black dress, asleep in the narrow bed she retreated to when she had the female problems that had plagued her since the abortion in the mid-20s. Leaning over the bed, I shook her awake.
"Have you come to apologize for going off with that slut?" she demanded.
"It's you who should apologize for walking out on the supper, for embarrassing me in front of my colleagues," I lashed out at her.
"If you do it again, Ubyo, I'll kill you."
No sooner had the words crossed my lips than I regretted them. Nadezhda was as fragile as chinaware, easily roused to hysteria and bouts of depression. It was then that she produced the small German Mauser that Pavel had given her along with the black dress. She was strangely calm as she removed all but one of the bullets from the pistol cylinder and spun it with her long, elegant fingers, as if she intended to play Russian roulette.
"Don't push me too far," I warned.
She made the mistake of taunting me.
"Were you hard with Galina tonight? Were you hard with the hairdresser or that girl in the typist's pool last week?
I can see from your expression you weren't. Of course they will tell everyone. You'll be the laughingstock of Moscow. For someone who prides himself on Bolshevik hardness, you are often limp."
"Here," she said, holding out the pistol butt first. "Prove to the world you are as hard as your alter ego, Ivan the Terrible, who in a fit of rage killed his own son." And I did prove it.
In the heat of the moment, I held the pistol to her heart, Mandelstam. I held it to her heart, and I pulled the trigger.
"And?" I asked, barely daring to breathe. "Did the firing pin fall on a bullet?"
"And is for me to know and you to imagine," Stalin said. "The servants discovered her body, stiff with rigor mortis in the morning. There were bruises on her face, though I have no recollection of hitting her. The pistol and the four bullets she'd taken from the cylinder were on the pillow next to her head. Vlasic came up with a doctor who was willing to sign a death certificate, listing the cause of death as peritonitis, which was the official version published in Pravda. But everyone in the Kremlin was convinced she had committed suicide." Stalin's eyes suddenly glistened with what I took to be inconsolability.
"She broke my life,"
he said so softly I had to strain to make out his words. Had I heard him correctly?
"She broke my life."
There was a tap on the door. The bodyguard Vlasic stuck his head into the room. "I have Yagoda's overnight list," he said. Stalin jerked his head, summoning him forward. Vlasic set several sheets of paper down on the desk. "Both Yagoda and Molotov have signed off on it," he said, uncapping a fountain pen and offering it to the Hossein. Stalin eyed the fountain pen suspiciously. "Was that made in Soviet Russia?" he asked. "Germany," Vlasic said, mortified. Stalin's eyes narrowed in displeasure. Ignoring the fountain pen, he selected a red pencil from a jar, filled with pencils. Then he ran a forefinger down the list, occasionally crossing out a name, muttering something about how terror, to be effective, must be random, scrawling ZA, approved, along with his initials on the top right-hand corner of each page when he'd finished with it. "Who is Akakim Geladze?" he asked at one point. "He's the Abkhazian, you nicknamed the Wolf. The commissar I sent to straighten things out in Georgia?" "That's the one." Stalin drew a line through his name and moved on. He asked about two other people he couldn't place. When Vlasic reminded him, Stalin left both their names on the list. "What have we here?" the Hossein exclaimed.
"Mandelstam, Osip Emilievich."
He looked over at me.
"You will be interested to know that Yagoda has included you for execution. He may be right. I have read your shitty little epigram."
"When all is said, you should be shot for writing a lousy poem." With my heart racing, he pretended to discuss the problem with his bodyguard.
"What shall we do with this Mandelstam?
On the one hand, I don't want to go down in history as the one who cut short the life of a Russian poet. On the other hand, it sets a bad precedent if I am seen to dither. People will mistake me for Lenin. So what will it be? Execute or isolate and preserve?" Sucking on his cigarette as he weighed the alternatives, the Hossein, to my everlasting relief, scratched a line through my name and, initialing the last of the pages, handed them back to Vlasic. "Tell Yagoda I haven't made up my mind about Mandelstam. He can add his name to tomorrow night's list. I'll decide then." "Will that be all?" the bodyguard asked. "There's one more thing," Stalin said. "Find out what became of a girl I once knew named Pelageya Onofrieva."
Chapter 10. Zinaida Zaitseva Antonova. Monday, the 20th of May, 1934. The last thing I expected was a reward, but the organs are known to treat collaborators generously, which is understood to be one of their ways of encouraging collaboration. So I can't say it came as a surprise when the Czechist buttonholed me in my dressing room after rehearsal one night and announced,
"We are eager to show our gratitude for your loyalty to Stalin and the revolution. It isn't every day that someone delivers evidence of treason written out in the traitor's own hand."
Several propositions rolled off the Czechist's tongue. An external passport and authorization to travel to Paris or Rome. Better roles in bigger theatres. A month-long all-expenses-paid vacation at one of those plush Black Sea hotels frequented by the nomenclatura. I favoured the visitor with one of what Mandelstam called my shame-faced glances. "I was only doing my duty as a Soviet citizen," I demurred shyly. "I ask for nothing." The Czechist, an older gentleman whose lips barely moved when he spoke, smiled as if we shared a secret. Several gold teeth in his lower jaw glistened with saliva.
"Surely there is some service the state can offer you to make your life easier," he insisted.
His tone managed to convey that my continuing to refuse could be misconstrued, could be taken to mean I had second thoughts about having collaborated in the first place. I honestly felt I had no choice but to accept. Which is why I averted my eyes in embarrassment and admitted, in the husky tone actors use on stage when they want to convey reluctance, "Perhaps there is one small thing." And I raised the delicate question of my risking the loss of my 22 square meters in the communal apartment off the Arbat and my Moscow residence permit if I divorced my husband. He pulled a small pad from his pocket and made a note to himself.
Proceed with the divorce, he instructed me. Leave the matter of the apartment and the residence permit in our hands.
He rose to leave. I saw him to the door and held out my hand. How can I thank you? I asked. Curiously, he didn't shake it.
There is no need to thank us, he replied. It is a point of pride with the organs to take good care of the people who work for us.
His words caught me by surprise. A retort spilled from my mouth before I knew what I was saying. I wasn't aware that I worked for you. He smiled indulgently, the way one would at a child who has uttered something vulgar, and said,
We don't believe in one-night stands.